From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. In nations scattered across the globe, people are rioting, not about political freedom or elections, but about the price of food. The United Nations estimates that world prices for food like rice, sugar, and wheat are 50% higher than they were a year ago. Here in the U.S., food banks are seeing a 20% increase in clients over last year. Worse, they're seeing a drastic decline in food donations. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the crisis with economist Bill Spriggs. He's a professor and chair of the economics department at Howard University. But right now, we have Robert Zacharitz. He's the director of advocacy and government relations for World Vision, a Christian nonprofit aid organization. Robert, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we're hearing reports of at least two people killed in Somalia as people protested over the cost of food. A few weeks ago, we saw civil unrest in Haiti. And what other countries and regions are experiencing this kind of crisis, and how severe is it?
You're seeing across the globe a short-term crisis. As the prices have gone up, it's putting pressure on people's budgets. And the World Food Program has estimated close to 100 million more people could be driven deeper into poverty. Areas of specific concern, you've mentioned Haiti, you've mentioned Somalia, places like northern Sudan, southern Sudan, Burundi, and Uganda are a couple other places.
Now, when we're talking about what's going on, give me a sense of, in general, what kind of prices there are for food relative to people's incomes, because obviously it's all about what you have versus what you need.
One of the biggest problems is you have a billion people who live on a dollar a day or less, and increasingly that does not go as far. And so people cannot get basic staples. We had a report coming from some of our programs in Afghanistan, people who are living on tea and bread. Because of the increase in prices, they're down to just using tea to live on.
Do you think that there's going to be more violence around these food prices?
When people are hungry, they can become desperate. And so I think you're looking at the appeal that's gone out from the World Food Program for additional $755 million just to keep existing programs going is critical.
What are we really talking about here? Are we talking about a lack of food? Are we talking about poor distribution? What's the cause of this?
There's multiple causes, and I think Bill can speak to that better on the economic causes. But with the increase of food prices, with increase in transportation costs, just difficulty on getting food. You're seeing that in the United States with the pressure on people's budgets to make ends meet. It's even tighter when you're on the brink of poverty. It pushes you into poverty.
Well, let me bring Bill in. Bill Spriggs, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
What do you think are the underlying economic causes of, you know, this food insecurity that's leading to violence?
Well, there are several. Bob mentioned the increased cost of transportation because of higher fuel cost. Then we also have speculation that's going on because of anticipation of increased demand for food. China is growing at a faster rate, and we know that contributes to higher fuel costs, but it also means that people in China are able to eat more and demand more food and demand food that's different than basic staples. They're able to eat more meat, and meat, of course, is not the most efficient way to consume food because you have to feed the animals first. So there are those pressures. There are weather conditions caused by global warming that have hurt some areas that used to be able to produce crops. So there are a number of factors that seem to be taking place that are boosting prices.
When we take a look at this, is there a situation where most of the countries that are highly affected are ones that just can't grow enough food or don't produce enough food and it all has to be imported, or at least a large portion has to be imported?
Well, they're the ones who are most directly affected by this unrest because they are poor. And the food price increase has been quite dramatic. So they don't have leeway for absorbing those increases in food prices. In the U.S., of course, we have a little bit more leeway. And as many people have observed, some of us may be eating too much. So we have a little different situation here in the U.S. The problem we have with our food banks is that as prices increase dramatically, it puts pressure on grocery stores, who often are a major source of contributions to local food banks. The grocery stores have to run more efficiently. And so as they cut costs and try and make sure that they don't have excess supplies, it means they have less to donate. And then individuals have less to donate. And then many food banks try to supplement the contributions they get in terms of canned goods and boxed goods and things that can store for a long period with fresh produce. And so they go on the open market often from donations to purchase eggs, milk, fresh vegetables, fresh fruit. And the prices of those things have been escalating, and it's hard for them to keep up with that demand.
Bob, I remember seeing not too long ago, just right around our office in the Crenshaw area of Los Angeles, a very well-dressed woman going around picking cans out of the garbage. And I figure that she must need the money to eat or to pay for prescriptions. She was of retirement age or past that. What kinds of situations are you seeing domestically?
In the domestic front, you're seeing an increase on the food banks and the soup kitchens. You're also seeing people who are just trying to manage their own household budgets as they're making changes in what they are purchasing. I know the Farm Bill is up before Congress. You're seeing some of the school lunch programs in the United States buying less nutritious food in order to continue to maintain those school lunch programs and on a regular basis.
What do you think is going to be the remedy for the domestic issue? I mean, we certainly here have plenty of food in the U.S. It's just a question of who it goes to. What's the solution?
I think one is, you know, the premier on the Farm Bill, as that's moving forward, which is the premier on our safety programs, on the food stamps, on school lunch and breakfast programs, and child nutrition programs. That's the government side. You're seeing the private sector, a lot of people pitching in through churches or community organizations, supplying those food banks with additional resources.
Bill, how does food bank work tie into the government? Is there government support, local, federal, state, for food bank, feeding programs, et cetera?
Well, yes, there is in many different ways. Part of it comes through the Farm Bill, which unfortunately, because it's been held up, hasn't been able to adjust its authorization level to meet the increased prices of some things. So there are central food banks which get food from the mechanisms of our Farm Bill. In addition to that, of course, there are food stamps. And then at the state and local level, there are some food banks that are assisted by community action agencies that are funded through a federal program, a block grant that goes to community action agencies. So there are myriad ways in which the money ends up coming through the federal government that's also matched at the local level by private donations and by individuals.
Going back to that point that you made about the types of food we eat, and meat being essentially more labor-intensive or just intensive in terms of the amount of calories it takes in grain to produce the meat, do you see consumption patterns changing back to a more vegetarian-based diet, at least for some people?
Well, the big problem we're having now is that some of the food price increase is coming from the increased demand for grains, part of that having to do with biofuel programs. So it isn't so easy for people to switch out of meat. The inflation for grains, in fact, has been quite severe. It's been quite severe for milk and dairy products and for eggs. So there's a big challenge for the folks who would say, well, I'd like to save the rest of the world and not eat meat because their prices of those goods have been going up.
Bob, when it comes to your organization, World Vision, how are you strategically looking at what you can do and what you can't do in this time?
We're trying to really look at both dealing with a short-term crisis and beginning to scale up programs that deal with long-term solutions. Some of these items are not going away anytime soon. And I think you can go about both. Many times the answer involves community organizations, both a response to the private sector and the public sector. So we're looking at resources, scaling up both the public and private side. We're looking at sustainable programs and to sustainable agricultural development, microcredit access to resources to begin that. And people can learn more at World Vision's website of what we're doing at www.worldvision.org for some of our longer term plans.
How long do you think it'll take? I mean, there's been a Nobel Prize awarded for microcredit work, and there have been a lot of things that have proven to work in the long term. But how far is the long term when people are hungry today?
That's it. I mean, the World Food Program's appeal is immediate now to keep people who are on the on programs continuing on those programs. We've been doing some of the long-term sustainable programs. There's a need to look at that, including the upcoming meeting of all the G8 leaders that's taking place in Japan, to look at what are some of the structural impediments for investing in sustainable agriculture for people in the developing world. They have access to credit, access to markets, access to inputs like fertilizer to help them feed their families and then produce extra to bring it to market.
Bill, how is this affecting children through things like school lunches?
Well, it's affecting children in the U.S. greatly. One of the big problems that we have in the U.S. is that wages in general have not been keeping up with inflation in general. We are going into the current recession with incomes actually lower than at the start of the recovery. So we went through a 7-year recovery and incomes, in fact, in the middle fell relative to prices. And people who are in the bottom 20% saw both their incomes fall, and because they can't borrow money, they aren't part of the debt crisis we're seeing, their consumption actually fell. And we know among poor families, the first thing they cut is food, because you still have to have shelter and you still have to pay the electric bill. And so those bills get paid up front and people cheat on food. So it affects children greatly. And in the U.S., unfortunately, a large share of those who are poor are children. So we have the effect of the school lunch program, which is being squeezed because of these and price changes that aren't being adjusted as quickly as we can with appropriations to account for the inflation. And then we have the problem of the WIC program being held up by the farm bill that we can't make the adjustments we need, and the food stamp program. And there's a big gap between Americans who are eligible for food stamps Bill. And Americans who get it.
All right. Well, Bill and Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Bill Spriggs is the chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University, and Robert Zachritz is the director of advocacy and government relations for World Vision. They both joined us from NPR headquarters studios in Washington, D.C. And just ahead, it could have ruined both of their careers, but now Barbara Walters is telling all about an affair with former Senator Edward Brooke, the first black senator since Reconstruction. That's on Bloggers Roundtable. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Now we move on to our bloggers' roundtable. An unpopular war, increasing unemployment, and high gas prices, they all spell high disapproval ratings for President Bush. 71% of Americans polled think Bush is doing a poor job leading the country. Those numbers are among the highest in history since polls started in the 1930s. So how does he rank against other unpopular presidents? To answer that question and more, we have Danny Perry. He's editor-in-chief for They're Already at blogspot.com. He's joined by Desmond Burton of afronerd.com and Kim Platt. She blogs at askthisblackwoman.com. Hi, folks.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
So, Danny, the president's numbers are even worse than Richard Nixon's were just prior to resigning from office. How do you think he rates in terms of his performance, not necessarily just the poll numbers, but how would you rate him in terms of performance?
Well, George Bush pretty much based the success of his presidency on the outcomes of the war in Iraq. And 5 years ago, he landed on the U.S. Abraham Lincoln and declared mission accomplished. And his approval ratings were very high at that time. But since then, the war has ground on. It's entering its 6th year. There have been more than 4,000 U.S. casualties with really no tangible benefit for the American economy. My kids will be paying for this, and the vets who are returning from this war are not receiving the care they need or deserve. Many of them are ending up homeless, and the damage to the American economy overall is beginning to show up in the price of gas and food and everything else. So it's really no surprise that his ratings have reached this low point. But, you know, the good news is that his team has been searching for what his legacy is going to be. And I think they found it, that these are the lowest ratings in American history. And no president has reached this level ever. So I believe that speaks for itself.
Desmond, when you think about the president, I want your estimation of him, but also considering that he's what we call a lame duck president, that he's counting down to the end of a 2-term presidency, does he even really need to care?
Well, I think he should care. I mean, if anything, he's an esteemed company. I say that facetiously with Harry S. Truman and Richard Nixon. I mean, if you can't outbeat, you know, Watergate, that's it's hell to pay to a certain degree. History has a weird way of looking at these things, though. I'm thinking of Dr. King. Dr. King in certain circles during the 60s was considered a threat to national security. And even by McCain did not even vote for his holiday. And yet now, years later, he's an esteemed person. He's definitely a iconic figure. So who's to say, I mean, maybe 30, 40 years from now, maybe Bush knows something that we do not. I hope that's not the case. But again, history is kind of a weird thing. I guess my main problem with it is that what are the disparate elements that are attached to the Bush administration going into this presidential campaign? Will it be race versus McCain following a third Bush term? So I think we're in a weird place right now.
Kim, how do you think he stacks up, particularly for African Americans? What's happened to black folk? You know, there's the Clinton era was, you know, are you better off? And a lot of people by the end of the Clinton presidency said yes. Now people are feeling insecure. What has happened to black communities, you think?
Oh, I think things are certainly worse for black communities. But I think part of the Bush legacy will be what he's done for Africa in terms of the HIV and AIDS initiatives there. And that seems to be the one thing that people are talking about that he has really excelled at and will be what he's remembered for. And so I think that black people will look at that. And, you know, I certainly think he is the worst president ever in the history of America. But what he has done in terms of the initiatives is great.
I'm going to go back to you for a second, Desmond. What do you think he has done for or against Republicans and conservatives? Has he created a cycle where Republicans and conservatives will be facing huge challenges in the Senate, in Congress, and possibly even in the presidential race?
I think, if anything, he has solidified the neocon movement more so than ever. I think that, unfortunately, for the moderates, how can I put this? If anything, it seems as if he has engendered religion forever at this point in our populace, that we will not be able to go beyond religion and religiosity because of the Bush administration. So I think he's definitely laid out some challenges, but in some regards, he has also pretty much solidified that what it means to be on the far right.
I'm going to move on to another topic, still in politics. Last week, Reverend Wright went on a media tour. Senator Barack Obama formally disowned his former pastor. During this time, some of his big-name supporters were suspiciously silent. We didn't hear from Jesse Jackson, senior or junior. You have been blogging about this, Danny. What do you think?
Well, I saw Charles Rangel on CNN, and he said that basically it's disgraceful that he has to make any explanation for anything, referring to Obama, that this intrusion of the media and Republicans into the sacred relationship that worshipers have with their spiritual leaders, I think, is going back to Ahanas. And strangely enough, Charlie Rangel is a Hillary Clinton supporter. So Obama has plenty of big name supporters on his side, from the Ted Kennedys to John Kerry's and Robert Reich's to Bruce Springsteen and Chris Rock and Samuel Jackson. And the list is endless, but no one's really stepped forward to highlight the hypocrisy of this whole issue, or that it's simply a distraction from the real issue the real issues that should be being discussed as a part of this campaign, including the war and the— I'm sorry.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think we haven't heard more from his surrogates?
Well, they're treating this issue basically as if it's radioactive. And there's the impression that or the conviction that among some that the supporting Reverend Wright would lead to some segments of the populace going against Barack Obama or solidifying their opinions against Barack Obama, and others who think that not supporting Reverend Wright would distance supporters of the black church from Obama. So it could alienate one segment or the other of the voting populace. But I think that in the case of Obama's surrogates, they need to actually step out and highlight these issues so that Obama himself is not caught in a tit-for-tat over every issue that arises from this point forward. And we had put up a post a week or so ago that we called a denounce, reject, and repeat, and which basically stated that Obama is going to find himself in a denouncement loop where right. he will find himself sooner or later denouncing everything, and he cannot change the fundamental fact of who he is, and the accumulation of his life experiences is what has brought him to this point where he is a viable candidate for the presidency. So in that respect, he should not be the one responding to issues of this, to every issue of this sort, when he has supporters whose role it is or should be to take some of this flack and to actually lead the charge on some of these issues, including Reverend Wright.
Kim, we've seen in North Carolina, which has its primary tomorrow, some erosion in the support for Barack Obama, who, you know, a couple weeks ago was considered a shoe-in winner in North Carolina by some polls. Do you think that this is really going to hurt him in the long run, not just the controversy over Reverend Wright, but the question of whether or not his surrogates are rallying around him?
I don't think that it will hurt him in the long run. I think it will die down for the most part. I do think, however, many of his supporters aren't rallying behind him because they agree with Reverend Wright. I think what Reverend Wright had to say was completely valid. It's, you know, I think if you're talking about a black experience and Barack is the, you know, the composite of all his experiences and he is where he is today, I think the same goes, or same holds true for Reverend Wright. His black experience came out of the black church. He is who he is. His opinions about race and oppression stem from seeing it firsthand in the black community. And I think, so I do think if there is some erosion from black supporters, it's because Reverend Wright spoke the truth. Maybe not in the right way, but he spoke the truth.
Desmond, let me go to another issue related about Obama. Recently, Senator Obama criticized Hillary Clinton's harsh words for Iran's nuclear capabilities. Now, some pundits are saying that he's soft on foreign affairs. In fact, in the New York Sun, there was a whole article saying the collapse of Obama, that was the title, and saying if anything is his Achilles heel, it's whether or not he is sufficiently strong in foreign policy. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's unfounded. I think in many ways, Hillary Clinton has not really been appropriately vetted out as far as her experience. She's no more experienced than he is, in my estimation. I think it's all about nothing. And if anything, we're being distracted from really finding out what he really thinks about the political issues abroad. He said something, if I recollect, about Pakistan and invading it. And then when Bush proceeded to do exactly what he had said weeks before, everyone stood back and said, wait a minute, this guy may know something about this. So I don't think that we're ever going to get that opportunity to really find out what he's talking about, because ultimately we're focused on Reverend Wright. And I just want to say something about Reverend Wright. I kind of have to disagree with Kim, because I think there's a book out by Jeremiah Kamara, called Holy Lockdown, Does the Church Limit Black Progress? And I think that this is perhaps the best example of that, where, in my estimation, this gentleman should have just laid low, as they say on the street, lay low in the cut. And he didn't do that. If you have a black person running for president trying to access power, he could have been, I guess, Obama's Jerry Falwell, in essence, if he had just laid back. But he spoke a truth. I don't know if it's the truth, but I have a problem with the whole Reverend Wright thing and how it's being put out there. He's literally like a Michael Jackson's black and white video. He's morphed into Malcolm X. So there's a problem.
All right. I want to reintroduce what we're doing. This is the Bloggers Roundtable on NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today, our guests are Danny Perry, editor-in-chief for ThereAlready.blogspot.com, Desmond Burton of AfroNerd.com, and Kim Platt of AskThisBlackWoman.com. So I'm going to ask this black woman about TV yes. host Barbara Walters. She's got a new memoir called Auditions, and she reveals...
She's got jungle fever.
Oh, you didn't go there.
Oh, but
she's black. She had an affair with Senator Edward Brooke. He was the first African-American to be popularly elected since Reconstruction into the U.S. Senate. Now, he was separated at the time of the alleged affair that took place in the mid-1970s. Apparently, not just a one-night stand, lasted for a while.
Okay.
He's still alive. He's not talking about this. He wrote a memoir not too long ago. Do you think this was appropriate for Barbara Walters to come out with this at this time?
I thought it was a bit odd. I think it's shocking that interracial relationships are still an issue. If he was separated, it's not really an affair, so to speak. I think it was a Barbara Walters moment of, you know, hey, I have a black friend, or I have black friends, and, you know, I'm down with the people. And
black friends with benefits?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I thought it was completely shocking. And I don't know, it's maybe an attempt to stay relevant and believing that some tawdry interracial sex is the way to do it.
You know, our Tony Cox here at NPR actually asked the former senator if he could support a black man as a candidate for the White House.
If you're asking me, Tony, whether I would vote for Barack Obama because he's a black American, an African American, my answer would be no. He would have to be the best person that is being offered by either one of the two political parties.
Desmond, there was no talk of sex in the memoir by the former senator. He was straight talking politics. At this point in time, sex sells. Maybe it has always for, you know, millennia. But when you talk about writing a memoir, which of course it's your choice as an author, where do you draw the line? Where do you think people should draw the line in terms of what they reveal about other people's lives in the course of discussing their own?
I'm not sure. I mean, normally, from my understanding, that person who's writing the memoir, they would have to speak to the person that they're talking about and ultimately get a clearance for that. You would think that's the way it goes. But I think, I think kind of lends credence with comedian Paul Mooney's assertion that she may have had a liaison with Richard Pryor. So, you know, maybe she has a thing for the brothers. I don't know.
Alan Greenspan. So
I'm a little bit, I think it's just about selling books. And as Kim had mentioned, it's passe now. I think that she's a little too, like 25 years too late. No one really cares about it. It's a non-issue at this point.
All right, this one is a quick speed round. Pure fluff, but if you're my age, which happens to be Mariah Carey's age, you might be intrigued. She became the act with the second most number one singles in the rock era. That's more than Elvis, Michael Jackson, second only to the Beatles. Now, in her latest video for her hit album, actor Nick Cannon plays her love interest. He's 27, she's 38. Rumors say that they are married. Neither has commented, but in People magazine, Cannon's brother Gabriel said, "It's crazy, right? We're definitely happy. Well wishes." That sounds like a wedding to me. Danny, this may be an unfair question, but why do you think there's this whole, if not May, December, at least sort of May, August thing going on between men and women right now?
Oh, wow. Well, celebrity news of this type, I usually refer to Miss Grapevine's blog, but I guess the only thing I can really say is that if the rumors are true, then I hope they are happy and that they make this thing work. I guess there have been stranger pairings in the celebrity world, but this one is one that I just never would have seen coming at all from the perspective that I have a 10-year-old daughter who likes Nick Cannon's film work and work on Nickelodeon, and Mariah Carey basically started performing or hit the big time when I was in high school. So
Your daughter
a bit
was
of a generation
even born.
Gap. Exactly. So
all right.
So well. it's a bit strange in that respect. But hey, if they say you like it, I love it. So more power to them.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
We were speaking with Danny Perry, editor-in-chief for ThereAlready.blogspot.com. He was at Cake Mix Recording Studios in Dallas, Desmond Burton of AfroNerd.com, and Kim Platt. She blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com. Desmond and Kim were both at our NPR studios in New York. Next on News and Notes, it's the economy, stupid. We talked to two voters in Indiana on the eve of the Democratic primary about jobs, 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 and how their state could shape the race for the White House. And as part of NPR's In Character series, NPR's Tony Cox profiles the king of the junkyard, Fred Sanford. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Tomorrow, voters in Indiana and North Carolina will head to the polls for the Democratic primaries. Of course, Senators Obama and Clinton each want to win, but what do the voters want? What issues are on the top of their agendas? To answer these questions, we have gentlemen from two different parts of Indiana. Amos Brown is host and managing editor of Afternoons with Amos on WTLC in Indianapolis, and Damon Broadhacker is the Morgan County Democratic Central Committee chairman. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here. Glad to be here.
So, Damon, let me start with you. A new poll conducted by CNN says the economy is the number one issue with American voters. The Iraq War is a distant second. Personally, what's your number one issue?
Clear and simple. In our county and most of the surrounding counties, it's the economy. I live about 30 miles south of Indianapolis, and clearly we need jobs. People are leaving our community to come to the city, and when they do that, now with the gas prices the way they are, they go to their job, they come back, and they don't have any basically time or money to spend in the local community.
Amos, let me turn to you. There's been some talk that the African-American community feels left out of this race. Do you think that's true where you are?
When I say left out, we're going to have a strong voter turnout among African-Americans tomorrow. One is powered by Senator Obama's entry into the campaign. The other is we have a very spirited, contested congressional primary on the Democratic side. Andre Carson, who succeeded his grandmother in a special election back in March, now is running again to fill the full term starting in January. There's two other African-Americans running a spirited campaign, plus a non-African-American candidate. That's also driving the vote. But I do agree, economy is the number one issue. In a city like Indianapolis, 13th largest city in the country, we have one of the worst public transportation systems in the nation. So people need a car in order to get around. And one of the issues around jobs is the next president, the next administration, figuring out ways to bring jobs into older neighborhoods.
When you think about what's going on in your community, are any of the presidential candidates speaking your language? I mean, how do you assess their responsiveness to what's going on right now?
I would say that if we could get the national media off of the distracting issues, whether it's Reverend Wright, whether it is, you know, is a gas tax holiday the best thing? Is it, you know, are you bitter? Get off of those issues and really address, how do you bring jobs to older neighborhoods of our city? How do you fix an economy? How do you extract us out of this mess in Iraq so we can reinvest dollars in the community? I think the candidates, at least from their websites, their white papers, have put out a lot of positions. It's getting that information down to ordinary voters so that they can really evaluate that.
Damon, what do you think about the level of rhetoric around issues like race? I mean, is it a necessary topic of discussion, particularly recently the Reverend Wright issue, or do you view it as a distraction?
Well, I personally view it as a distraction because our issues are much bigger than that. I agree with what Mr. Brown has been saying. There are so many things that are bigger to us. But the biggest thing to me is that we want, and I want to know that what I feel, what I need matters. And I think both of the candidates have been addressing that. I matter. And that's what is most important in this campaign.
When you talk to your friends, your family, people in your community, do people feel like they have enough sense of who the candidates are to make an informed decision?
Well, I think so, because we're basically an informed nation. If we're not informed, it's our fault if we're not informed. So that doesn't really bother me one bit.
I'm going to use an example. We've got a contested governor's race on the Democratic side. Two great candidates. They put out positions, but the majority of Democratic voters in every poll are literally undecided this late in the election, whereas everybody, I think, has their mind made up or leaning to who they're going to vote for in the Democratic primary for the president. I think people know the issues between Clinton and Obama, and I think it does get down to a comfort level. Who do you feel is the best to take the fight to John McCain in the fall? Who would make the best person in the Oval Office? But that has sucked the life in a primary like ours of some other candidates where the people haven't gotten the information. I think people are engaged in this presidential race. They know a lot about these candidates. They bring issues to my attention that maybe I have not thought of.
Amos, you know, Joe Andrew, the superdelegate and former head of the Democratic National Committee under President Clinton, switched his support from Hillary Rodham Clinton to Barack Obama, and he said that Barack Obama is the Bill Clinton of 2008. What do you think about a statement like that, and do you think that after these contests, yours and North Carolina's, that this will get wrapped up?
I don't think it gets wrapped up. I think this thing is going all the way until the last, you know, voter gets to vote in the primary. But I saw something last night. I was at that Jefferson Jackson Day dinner, and I had to go in, you know, that early clearance, you know, press to be screened and all of that. But outside the convention center, there were two demonstrations by supporters of Hillary Clinton and supporters of Barack Obama. And Barack Obama had a couple of hundred supporters, a lot of young people, a lot of African Americans. They had drums, they were beating, they were chanting. And I called a Republican friend in the media, Republican talk show host that was there, and I looked at him, and he kind of turned his nose down at those demonstrators. I said, no, that reminds me of young people who were into Ronald Reagan, who showed that passion and that dedication to Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. That's what I see in Barack Obama, to see the faces of black and white young people in Indiana inspired by Barack Obama. I think that is something different, and that's something that I've not seen in the Clinton campaign. Even I've been to both of their appearances, and he seems to connect better.
Damon, Bill Clinton has been visiting the state. Do you think at this point he is helping his wife? I mean, there's been some controversy about whether or not he actually has eroded support among some voters.
Well, actually, the former president came to Martinsville a week ago last Sunday night and gave a very informative speech. And I don't know so much if he's helping her campaign as he is helping people understand what the issues are.
One of the things I noticed with the president, he is going to the smaller communities, and no disrespect to Martinsville, but he is going to the smaller communities in the state today, both here and in North Carolina. That's one of the big surprises. I thought when this campaign started in Indiana, Bill Clinton would be reaching out to the African American community. I think the Clinton campaign is not having him do that. They're having him concentrate on Democrats and independents in where the majority of Hoosiers live, and that is in our smaller cities and towns all throughout the state. The one odd thing about Indiana that makes Indiana unique, even though Indianapolis is the largest city, the majority of the state lives outside of what I call the Beltway. And so this election is going to be decided by, you know, ordinary Hoosiers out in our cities and towns and rural areas and places that have been hurting.
Well, gentlemen, you have given us a lot of great information. I want to thank you both.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you for having us, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
Amos Brown is the host and managing editor of Afternoons with Amos on WTLC in Indianapolis. And Damon Brodhacker is the Morgan County Democratic Central Committee chairman. Stubborn, argumentative, and sarcastic. Not exactly the kind of endearing qualities that create a connection between a television character and audiences. But that's precisely why millions tuned into a fictional inner-city junk man. Today is part of NPR's series In Character, a look at the fictional American characters that have had an impact on our lives. We take a closer look at Fred Sanford. A warning to our listeners, we'll be hearing clips from the show that contain language that includes racial epithets.
It was the winter of 1972 when Sanford and Son was introduced to America's primetime TV audience on NBC.
Oh, is this the Ace Plumbing Company? Yeah, well, this is Fred Sanford. Sanford, as S-A-N-F-O-R-D, period speaking.
Comedian Red Fox was cast by producers Norman Lear and Bud Yorkin to play the gruff 65-year-old curmudgeon Fred Sanford. With his trademark suspenders, gravelly voice, and scraggly beard, Sanford lived in a Watts junkyard with his son Lamont, played by DeMond Wilson. Fred's intimate and often emotional interaction with Lamont offered a slice of black family life rarely seen on network television at the time. Bud Yorkin.
The character between the son and the father was very interesting to me and to Norman, in the sense that despite the fact that they lived together and complained and so forth, what was interesting to me was the fact that they couldn't live without each other. And so that's what we based the idea on.
How would you like one across your lips?
The idea for the show was actually based on a British television comedy about two London junkmen called Steptoe and Son, but with one major difference. Both Fred and Lamont were black.
All right, now we've got rid of the stuff and everything's been taken care of. You're happy?
Happy. I got a truckload of copper at the bottom of the ocean. I'm out of $40 and I'm sitting here with my dummy son. I didn't know a black man could be so happy.
That created challenges and opportunities for Fred and the rest of the show's cast to break new and sometimes controversial ground. Black audiences were crucial for the show's credibility, but white audiences had to embrace Fred Sanford if the show was to succeed.
You can't do a show that's dealing with Afro-Americans that the Afro-Americans don't like and don't want. And you don't want to do it so that it's just the Afro-Americans love it, but the other people don't want to see it. So you have to go in between.
Hey, Pops, how you feeling this morning? Feel with my hand like I always did.
Fred Sanford's wit, down-home honesty, and sometimes acerbic comments were a hint of the actor who played him. Prior to his role on Sanford and Son, Red Fox was an established nightclub performer, famous for his adult humor.
Here was a guy who went to the doctor. He said, Doc, look at here. Doc said, you ever had that before? He said, uh-huh. Doc said, well, you got it again.
As Fred Sanford, he toned down his humor for television, but according to show writer Paul Mooney, he toned it down only so far.
Red Fox's character was too arrogant, too uppity. The things that he did and said, please, he could get lynched for less in Mississippi. Now, let's not try to be naive.
I'm driving along a street in Hollywood, see? All of a sudden, there's this woman standing out by the curb, messing around in the trash cans in front of a house.
White woman?
Yeah. Pop, this woman was about 90 years old.
Ain't nothing on earth uglier than a 90-year-old white woman.
It was written to be undignified.
Black television historian and author Fred McDonald says while Sanford and Son was groundbreaking, it was also dangerously reminiscent of the crude and unsophisticated African-American characters portrayed on the 1950s television show Amos and Andy. The difference, McDonald says, is that Fred Sanford successfully tiptoed the line between minstrelsy and mainstream comedy.
He was always, you know, attacking, slashing, a little bit out of control and scheming. So in that regards, you could put him in the line with the characters such as George Kingfish Stevens from Amos and Andy. But at the end, he was offset by the positive characters around him. And that balanced it.
Characters like Aunt Esther, Fred's Bible-toting sister-in-law played by LaWanda Page, who gave as good as she got.
Aha!
Where'd you come from?
Where you think I come from?
Under a rock.
You can't talk yourself out of this one, you two-timing beady-head weasel-eyed fool.
Like Norman Lear's seminal 1970s sitcom All in the Family, Sanford and Son also tackled taboo topics. In this clip, Fred takes on a prejudicial justice system with his distinct homespun philosophy and language.
Why don't you arrest some white drivers?
I do.
You do? Well, where are they? Look at all these niggas in here. Look around here. There's enough niggas in here to make a Tarzan movie.
Sanford and Son producer Bud Yorkin remembers Red Fox campaigning to use the N-word in that episode.
He said, "Let me do that stuff. I want to be able to say that." And I said, "Well, you know, I don't feel comfortable with it, but if you feel I can do it, you can't do it. I don't want somebody else doing it, but I can do it." So I said, "Well, okay, Red, you know," and he did it. And by and large, we never got any complaints.
Indeed. The show's blend of comedy and controversy lasted for 135 episodes over 6 seasons. For 5 of those seasons, Sanford and Son was among the country's top 10 rated television shows.
You know what I've decided to do? I'm going to do missionary work. Probably be going to Africa. I'll be doing work among your people.
Not mine, my people in St. Louis.
Today, Fred Sanford is still wobbling around his junkyard on arthritic knees via syndication 36 years after his network debut. But what draws younger viewers and old fans to the little junkyard in Watts week after week? The junk man who ran it, says Bud Yorkin.
You felt more for him than you did for his son, because after all, the son was young, and you didn't want to hear him complain to the father, and he ruined it. I had a date tonight, and you bring in 3 guys that want to sit down and play poker with you. And why, how can you do that to me, Dad? And we get into a whole scene. Well, you feel sorry for the father more than you do for the son. But there was no doubt that they loved that character.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the best-dressed man of all? Give me my answer and make me contented. Make it quick. Because this suit is rented.
Tony Cox, NPR News.
That was the latest installment of NPR's In Character series, and we want to know, what great American characters inspire you? Nominate your favorites on our In Character blog. Go to npr.org/incharacter. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the opposition leader in Zimbabwe got the most votes in the country's presidential election, but the ruling party wants a runoff. We'll have the latest in Africa Update.